This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details. This is episode 5, and we recorded it 5th, back in January 2022. Hello and welcome to episode 5 of our Prisoner podcast, By Hook or By Crook. This week we are looking at The Schizoid Man. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Luke. And you've got somebody there. You've got a new number 3.
We have it. Yes, our number 3 this week is my brother. Hello.
Hello.
You are, this is John to, well, I mean, you're John to me, but only my brother to me, not to Michael. So you're my older brother. I think it's slightly your fault that I'm into The Prisoner. But what is your recollection of how you first got into The Prisoner and what made you a fan?
Well, I'm sure, as you must have mentioned in an earlier episode, it was for our dad. So along with pop culture references from the 60s, such as Tony Hancock, Big Hand, Little Hand, The Whereabouts, and things like that, there were also quotes from The Prisoner that would have been somewhere, "I am not a number, I am a free man." And things like that. So I was brought up with the knowledge that there'd been this amazing television series called The Prisoner, which had been filmed at Port Merion, which is somewhere that we went to on holiday when I was very small, because there's a picture of me, I must be about maybe 2 or 3, sitting in one of the little prisoner cars, which I know when we went back a long time later, you weren't allowed to sit in anymore. So we've got that. So I was brought up with that photo. At the age of maybe 11, I asked for, which must have been recently reissued at the time, a copy of the Thomas Dish book, A Day in the Life. And I read that and I couldn't really make head nor tail of it, because from what I remember, I don't have it anymore. It starts off a bit like Arrival, and then it's got bits of other episodes in, including The Schizoid Man, because I remember the quote about your best chance would be battle axes in a very dark cellar that appeared in the book, but the book was a bit of a hodgepodge. So I didn't really think much more about it at the time. And then I think probably when I was about 15, I was in Virgin Megastore near to Orchard Square in Sheffield. And in the video section, as it was still in those days, there was this set of prisoner videos. And so I bought the middle video, because the ones with just 3 episodes on were cheaper than the ones with 4 episodes on. So I got hold of a video with Checkmate, Hammer into Landville, and It's Your Funeral. And so we watched those, presumably, as a family, and then I got the rest for subsequent birthdays and Christmas. So within a year, I probably had all of them.
My recollection of Checkmate being the first episode that we watched. So clearly, either our memories are both cheating, or we're both remembering correctly that that's where we started.
I know that I'm remembering correctly, because it was my video and I'd gone to buy it. And because we know that my recollection of these sorts of things is better than Luke's popped out. you can always edit that out if you like.
No, I mean, I'm happy to leave that in, and people can wonder what the obscure reference is. I thought you were going to go with Okie Doke and Noddy, to be honest, but anyway.
That had them just come to mind now. So I don't think we need to have any worries on that score. And so I watched them a lot at that time. I probably watched them when I was still at uni. And then I did get a DVD. And then I got them on DVD, probably about 15 years ago. Watched them then. And I haven't done since. But in the last couple of years, I knew that you had a podcast in mind. And I was like, well, when Liv does the podcast, that's when I will rewatch them. I will save rewatching them until then. So I watched Arrival the other day, and then I want to wait to watch the others when your podcast actually comes out. So right. I've only then rewatched the schizoid man the other day.
So you are our target audience then?
Yes, yes. I have been waiting for such a thing to come along.
Yeah, well, I will be intrigued as to what you make of our journey and what other people make of the show. So I guess the big question is what drew you to the show? I mean, it's slightly odd because my recollection is that maybe we watched some before you bought the video, but clearly it was reading the book and going, this is interesting enough, and Dad and kind of going on Dad's recommendation. But having watched that first video, what was it that made you go, oh, I really like this and want to carry on?
Well, it's the central character, the central performance of Patrick McGowan is this very driven individual who has found himself in this place, which, I mean, I wouldn't at the time, but which now I to call sort of Kafka-esque situation where he's being locked up. He doesn't really know why. I mean, he does know why, because they want to find out why he resigned, but we don't really know why that's important, and maybe he doesn't know why that's important, and of how he's dealing with that, trying to not conform with the system, trying to escape at the same time, and all whilst wearing his very distinctive jacket, speaking in very quotable terms, and managing to sort of beat the system and ultimately defeat the system, or does he? So it's just fun, but also, but yeah, just you can't fully analyze, you can't fully give an explanation for what it's supposed to be. But I just find it interesting.
So one question that we're asking everybody, and you've slightly alluded to it, so it may be that you don't have anything more to say, but there's lots of different interpretations to the prisoner. What does the prisoner mean as you understand it?
So I suppose being oneself, then you don't have to answer necessarily to anybody else. But I don't think I think about it all that sort of deeply, really.
Because you can take it on face value as almost a sequel to Danger Man and be like, well, this is just another 60s spy drama with elements of science fiction in it. Or you can kind of go digging deeper and go, well, what McGoon was trying to say something, even if he remained enigmatic to the last. Do you enjoy it more on that first level, or are you interested in digging into it?
No, I guess culturally, with like any sort of storytelling medium, I am like, what you see is what you get. What's right on the screen is what there is. And if it's not on the screen or on the page, then the writer creator has not put it there. And yeah, you're free to interpret it how you want, or if you don't want. We'll see whether in this episode you take a particular point of view about something which I think is key to my reading of the story, whether you've ever noticed that or whether you think it holds water, or not.
Well, I look forward to getting to that point. What you said, you watched them a lot on VHS. I recall those years, and then you got them on DVD. But why haven't you revisited the show since then?
Just for having lots of other stuff to watch and to do. So I suppose rewatching them now will be nostalgic for that time of life. But at the moment, I find it very hard to rewatch anything or to think of even really good series. Well, when am I going to rewatch those? Because I'll have something new to watch then.
Yeah.
So I guess also, you know, thinking, hoping at some point that my children might be interested in them, although that seems at the moment quite unlikely, really. But see whether it can be passed on to the next generation.
Cool. Before we dive into the episode, when we were planning this, you had, I think, a couple, two or three possibilities of like favourite episodes. So aside from the Schizoid Man, what are your top choices of good prisoner episodes that you would want to get people to watch?
Oh, I suppose, well, it's easier for me to say what are the clunkers which I'll struggle to watch even when going through the podcast series. So Free For All is important, but I find it exceptionally weird. Doubts of Death, I don't have any time for that. And A Change of Mind is not particularly interesting. I don't find it in terms of how the episode works, although perhaps nowadays, with all the talk of being unmutual, it is a metaphor for our times. But I'd say those are the three that I'm not particularly interested in.
Right.
If this hadn't have been available, I'd have been happy to have talked about any of the other episodes.
Right. Okay.
I think.
And you, without doing any spoilers, because we're quite early on in the run here, how do you feel about the end?
The end is, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, and just imagine if that final episode could have been shown when they had social media. The internet would have gone into meltdown. Twitter would have been broken. Mm. You know, you'd have had, you know, Patrick McGowan's Twitter feed would have been horrendous. I mean, I think as it was, he kind of had to disappear for a bit because people were like, well, what was that? And I think, you know, I am still, well, what is that? But then I knew beforehand that it was going to be weird because that's what Dad had said, and that it wasn't necessarily going to make sense. But I think probably, given that it was only 17 episodes, that's probably, less than... I never watched it, but like Lost, I hear that the end of Lost was quite a disappointment to people, and that the last series of Game of Thrones was not what people were hoping for.
But after just people had invested years and years and years into those programs. Yeah. Mm. Okay.
Yeah. It's like, well, okay, that was that. I don't know, but somehow it fits with the rest of the series somehow, in a sense which a more conventional ending probably wouldn't have.
Okay. Cool. So let's dive into this week's episode, The Schizoid Man, which is a story where we pull out the science fiction staple of number six has a doppelganger, and we play with that within the context of the village. So why did you want to talk about, well, or what do you want to say about the plot of this particular episode?
Well, I think that the sort of classic sci-fi, as you say, but also classic mystery fiction, which I'm very big into, is on people having doubles, is on people impersonating people. And I think the idea of someone taking your place is a sort of a very unlikely thing to happen, but in my mind, one of the most potentially scary things that could happen to you. I see three basic ideas of, well, one, that you suddenly wake up and you're invisible. No one can perceive you. Nobody can hear you. Two, that you turn up and people don't recognize you, or they say that they don't know who you are. And then thirdly, moving on to literally someone has taken your place, either who looks like you or who doesn't look like you, but you turn up to work and you're like, and they're like, yeah, but that's the role that Michael does. Michael's always done that job. You say that you're this accountant, but, you know. And a very simple and easily explicable, but which happened to me once, when I was working for Barclays, in a call centre, was we had to do weekend shifts every so often, and an early shift started at 7 o'clock, and this was in winter. So I turned up to the office early. You had to get there so that you could log on and everything. So it's early in the morning, hardly anybody's around. And I went up to my floor where my desk was, and I walked out onto the floor plate. And it was like my floor plate, but it was all wrong. It wasn't quite right. And for a slight moment, I'm there going, what on earth happened? And the simple thing was that somehow I'd got off the floor too early. I'd climbed the stairs and got onto the wrong floor. So that's easy. But that minute bit of where you're tired and you're like, just what's going on? Imagining that that had actually happened and I turned up to work and being like, yeah, well, your team doesn't work here. There was no one called your mom. You know, that sort of thing has stayed with me, I think, as that sort of idea of what you're sort of doing.
Yeah, but you weren't shouting, where am I? I'm on a slightly different floor at work. Doesn't work for where am I? You're in the village. But I get exactly what you're saying. I've had the same thing happen to me. I totally get it.
I did the whole, when I had a hire car in the States, I did the whole going to the wrong car and trying to get into the wrong car. And Hannah went one step further when she, because a friend of hers had parked somewhere and then had moved her car without telling her, and then another car of the same make parked in the spot, and Hannah went to get something from the car, and then a mate came out going, "You're in the wrong car." So, we have those moments of suddenly kind of being, oh, reality's on the blink, as it were, or it's thrown as a curveball. Obviously, in this case.
Yeah,
it's that third scenario that we're talking about, John, where there's literally somebody else that looks like him, who he's being told is him, and he is being set up to be the imposter. In that, like, it's like you're number 12, and you're here to break number 6. So it's there's a kind of double layer of how they play it on him, to get him to crack up.
That's the genius bit of this particular story for me, because it would have been dead easy to do the we've brought someone in who looks like you, but convincing him that he isn't himself and that he's there to crack the person who is himself, who is the copy or clone or, you know, spy who's had the plastic surgery, however you want to do That's the thing that separates this from other episodes of other shows for me.
I think there's also the fact that you never ultimately get an explanation as to why Curtis looks like number 6.
No, well,
there's not he's had plastic surgery so he looks exactly like him.
Yeah,
there just happens to be a doppelganger.
Number 2 says he just happens to look like him, which I think is a bit dubious. But that's the conversation that we're privy to, where the lying shouldn't be. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's the who's lying to who at what point aspect of this as well.
And you kind of need charts and all sorts and big fluke. But he said, oh, you happen to look like him. But how do they make Kurt? And also, does this reflect back on the, you know, the gardeners who are all the same person and the same actor reoccurring? Basically, can the village clone people? Or not? And if they can, have they just put Kurt inside this number 6 copy body? Or am I completely overthinking this? Seriously, I've given this too much thought.
I mean, part of the crux of the episode is that he has a life outside of the village and a past with number 2.
Yeah.
Because that's how, in the end, number 6 gets rumbled. So we have to believe that Curtis exists as a person.
Desperate to make a Fresh Fields gag at this point, but that's pointless because I can't actually figure out how to introduce Anton Rogers, who was in a sitcom called Fresh Fields, and I just need to introduce that as a sort of pun. But I've been racking my brains. I can't come up with one, so let's just let that one go. Yeah. So he has got the history with him. You're right. Beforehand.
So, John, what do we make of one of the aspects of the series? Obviously, is that there's a new number 2 every week. What do you like or dislike about Anton Rogers as number 2?
I think he's very good. I thought that he came across as more charming than he actually is. But he seems to be quite sort of cheery, bantering with number six as number 12. Yes, but actually, but then when he plays, when he's like playing up at like being cross, but he's like, why was there no mole on number 12's wrist? It does sound quite alarming, even though that's just him pretending. And then when he gets worried, when he finds out the Braver has killed his number six, I think he plays the role very well. And then especially as you see him towards the end of the episode become suspicious about what has happened. And also show a more human side of number six, which I'll go into. A more human side of a number two, which I'll go into later. But just to come back to the previous point in about number six having to determine who he is and retain his own identity, is that he has to keep telling people, I am number six. But normally he doesn't take that identity on because he doesn't want to be number six. He wants to be himself, but he's forced to give himself a label that he wouldn't normally agree with, just to go, well, I'm not number 12. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to call myself number six, even though he doesn't normally refer to himself as that. I mean, he answers to that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't go through the series going, well, if you call me number six, I'm not going to answer you. You know, I'm just going to ignore you. But he actually has to own that identity for once, which I think is interesting because that's another level of...
He starts off by saying, you're number six, as a kind of I'll play along kind of a way at the beginning. But he actually does shout at one point, I am number six. And you're like, well, okay then.
Yeah.
It's claiming ownership of something he didn't want.
It's a very impressive performance from McGoohan, because I feel that, I mean, obviously as well as the costume, you have the deliberate parody of his costume in white. But you know from his performance immediately which of the two versions of himself that he's playing at all times, I think.
You do.
There's the voice, and there's also the fact that as the fake number six, he's not nice. Like, there's an undertone of like, because number six is arrogant, right? But he's the hero of the show, and we kind of like him in spite of that. But I feel that the doppelganger has none of that warmth to him.
It's what's the word? Hang on, I've got it written down. Supercilious. I've got that word. Because that's condescending, I suppose. Yeah. But number six can be, but he often. You're right. It's a lot more subtle than you, because you know it, and yet it's the same guy doing all the parts.
And it's technically really impressive.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed this, Michael. One of the drawbacks, actually, of watching The Prisoner on Blu-ray is that all the split-screen shots are slightly more noticeable. At least this is to my mind, is that because all of those shots have been optically processed back in 1967, there's a level of degradation of the film, which when you scan it at high resolution and bung it on a Blu-ray, you can immediately see, that's a split-screen shot. I mean, apart from the fact that there's two Patrick McGoohans in it, so it's obvious that it's two Patrick McGoohans. But
the
that
DVD
aside,
is all right.
That aside, technically, it's amazing in that, like, you never... I mean, there's part, I think the bit where he smokes a cigarette, there's a bit of smoke briefly drifts across the split. But otherwise, you can't really tell. And they get very close. They get very close to each other at various points, and he does a really good job of kind of looking at himself as he walks past. and then kind of obviously cutting back and forth. Also, the wig on Frank Mayer's head, like, and the way he stands and the way he moves as Patrick McGoohan's double, I think is absolutely amazing. He gets the physicality down pat. Yeah.
He just does.
What do you think, John? Would you agree with that? Do you think it works on that level?
I think it does. There was only one that when they end up fighting, there was only one shot where I was like, "That's like," which was like badly done, where you could see that it was somebody else in a very close up shot. Just coming back to the point about the fake number six. I mean, I think thinking about that now, I think that is how the professional number six would have been, possibly, as the agent before he resigned, how he would have treated other people in his line of work, potentially at times when like he was dealing with people who he needed to dominate, break down, get them to do things that they didn't want to do. Necessarily.
Sorry, a thought just occurred to me. Perhaps Kurt or the fake six is actually Danger Man. That'll mess with people's heads.
He's John Drake. Interesting.
Yeah, and he happens to look a lot like the scientist that they've got cornered as number six.
Oh yeah, so this is the point, John, where you have to be introduced to the fact that Michael has been reading an analysis of The Prisoner by Alex Cox, who I think is most famous for directing Repo Man, isn't he?
Mm.
And his theory...
He used to introduce Movie Drome on BBC Two years ago.
His theory, based upon the "I want to be the first man on the moon" in taking that literally, is that he thinks that number six is a rocket scientist, doesn't he? That was his secret kind of agent role. He was actually working on a rocket program.
Because he's a terrible spy. He's got very few actual spy qualities, but he is very intelligent, and he keeps coming up with scientific solutions to things, rather than sort of John Drakey spy stuff. I'm just going with that as a theory because it does keep coming up. And the sci-fi stuff with the cloning also fits in as well. Personally, I'm a bigger fan of the idea that he's one of the people and he's actually in charge of... He invented the village and he's there testing it out, which is why they're not allowed to just break him. They've wiped his memory, which we know they can do. And then he's gone, right, you're here... You've apparently resigned. That's your secret, which doesn't really mean much. And we have to break you. We have to see if it's fit for purpose, the village itself. There's a couple of things we really need to talk about. And for me, the important bit is number 24. It's Alison.
Yeah.
Because this is the closest he gets to actually having a relationship with someone. And clearly Patrick McGoohan's gone, yeah, we'll have this as a storyline. Now, obviously, there's the whole... In the original script, they were just supposed to kiss, and that's how they would reveal it. But they replaced it with the use of the psychic Xena cards, with the, you know, is it a square, is it wavy lines, or whatever. And they replaced it with that, which it works, but it also feels really pseudoscience for what the prisoner is. So that relationship between her and the way that it's used as a plot device is... It's a bit weird.
Yeah.
But also she's a photographer and the fact that she took the photographs helps solve the problem, the case as well. So that all fits together. She's a tremendously important. But how come she gets to use the word Alison even when number two's phoning her up? And it's like, oh, hello, Alison. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't come around and solve the plot because I'm washing my hair. What? That was just weird. But getting away from that, Yeah, so she's so important to the plot. I mean, I know she actually gets... Is it me, or does she actually get higher billing than Anton Rogers at the beginning?
I think they're on the same card.
Okay, because that doesn't happen very often. So she's so important. So that's good. But I do find it weird that they've gone down the paranormal route so easily without it being questioned But I suppose it was the summer of love almost, where that kind of thing's in the air.
So I was thinking about that because so when I was thinking about it, I was thinking, well, I'm in the village, cameras are everywhere. So the village could easily set this up as fake. So they're filming what's on the card, they're telling her what it is. That's how it's done.
Potentially. Oh, that makes sense. That makes total sense.
Because if she does have a psychic link with the real number six, then there must be some trickery going on with fake number six, because she unlikely to have a rapport with both of them. But then I was thinking, well, why is number six playing along with this? But perhaps he's just bored. Perhaps he's just like, well, let's just do it. Perhaps he's not thinking about this.
But it's the happiest you see him in the entire series. When he's sat at the kitchen sort of side, chatting away, you never see him that happy again. You never see him that chatty, that at ease at living in the village than he does in this episode. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've misremembered something. But he actually seems fairly content with this person who we've never seen before, we never see again. But obviously that's just the way the story unfolds. That's what we're there for. But I just find it odd. But you're right. You're totally right about an earpiece. It's like, oh, I'm doing a magic trick. Can you show the audience? And then the whole of the audience get to see it. And you're like, well, so yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I finally get that. Because I've been sort of sat at work going, so how do you do that as a magic trick? And the answer is, well, everyone can see it, you idiot. Yeah. So yeah,
That hadn't occurred to me, to be honest. Like you were talking about, John, you were talking about taking things on face value, and I've never really thought to. I mean, it occurred to me while I was watching. Like, there is no explanation given in the episode.
Yeah.
So you can just take it as they have a genuine psychic link. That is one interpretation of what you see in the episode. But equally, yeah, there's nothing to say that we know from at the end that she's in on it. Therefore, she could just be one of the normal guardians of the village that we see every week.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it before either, but I find watching it with a specifically critical eye, I've noticed a lot more things and maybe potential problems, other things. My only issue with it is then, well, yeah, what is number six's motivation in being involved in this? Or maybe, you know, perhaps he does think there is something in it. But anyway, coming back to things that you don't see before, and Michael's point about him being a rubbish agent, is watching the title sequence and going, well, he doesn't notice that he's being tailed. He just drives by and he doesn't notice all these undertakers following him and try to do anything about it. That struck me as like, oh, this.
Well, I suppose that lends credence to the theory that he's in on it, that he knows he's going to be taken to the village. In the title sequence, but yes,
I've got a question I need to ask our listeners. Right. And to be fair, you two will probably know the answer, and I may have reached almost 50 and be of the wrong opinion of something. So bear with.
Right.
Flapjacks.
Oh, yes. Right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They're pancakes or crepes, right? What's going on there? Because a flapjack for me is like an oaty bran biscuity thing. Yeah. Maybe it's usually a tray bake.
Yep.
You slice it. It's like a power bar kind of a thing.
Yep.
You can eat it throughout the day. Probably made with syrup. That kind of... Am I wrong?
No,
Have I been giving the wrong name for the wrong thing for
England.
Years?
Yeah.
So that's always bothered me. And I've been like, because to me... I always had an idea that Americans call them flapjacks. And so because of coming on the podcast, after watching the episode, I looked it up and I did some research.
Oh my God, he's done research. This. Bless him.
Oh, bless him. So what you need to know, Michael, is that my brother has a blog where he reads Agatha Christie novels and he researches them every time. So I expected this level of kind of delving into it from
tell
him.
Tell me more. Put me out of my misery, please.
So because I think... The reason that they referred to them as flapjacks in the story must be because of knowing there was going to be an American audience at some point. But when I looked it up, in some parts of America, they call them flapjacks, but mainly call them pancakes, and some places do both. But the original Shakespeare talks about flapjacks in the sense of pancakes. So flapjack was the original English word or a word for a pancake, because the flap comes from like flip, so it's like a flip something. And although now in the UK, I think it would be wholly used for the oaty tray bake type flapjack
right, yeah.
that we know in this country. Apparently, that usage was not in a written recipe form calling it a flapjack until 1935.
I bow to your superior knowledge. That is it. That's we're done. We do not need to podcast anymore. We have enough facts. We're fine. Thank you so much for sorting that out.
I thought you'd probably have an answer to that, John. So thank you for clearing that up. But you said there was a few things you wanted to come back to that we haven't talked about yet. Maybe where do you want to go further with the episode?
So I think in terms of ultimately what happens, the ending few minutes, I think, provides me more emotional depth than you get in the rest of the series, in terms of Alison's admission to him that if she had another opportunity, she wouldn't betray someone again, where she knows that he knows that she knows. So in saying that, she is having her second time, and she's not betraying him this time, because she could have told them, oh, well, I know that he's not the fake number six and he's going to escape. So she gets to tell him in a way that's not...
How does she know? How does she know that he's not, that he's the real number six?
Because they have the moment with the lighter. Because he's trying to tell her that he's the real number six, I think. Anyway, that's my reading in the sea, because he says, oh, habit playing with lighters, because he spins around and she's got the cigarette ready. So I think he's trying to tell her, even though that's a risk, and she's telling him, well, if I had another opportunity to do the wrong thing, I wouldn't do the wrong thing. And in doing that, she's not doing the wrong thing. Hmm. So I think that's brilliant.
I had completely missed that, because I'd forgotten that the whole lighter thing was obviously, that was a thing that number six, the real number six did, but they programmed him to use matches as number 12.
Yeah.
So that although it was Curtis doing the lighter thing earlier in the episode, that was a thing that number six did. Yes, okay. I had not seen it, because my reading of it was based on the fact that she didn't know. And that it was a genuine, I'm telling you, or I know I won't get a second chance, but I'm telling you anyway. But actually, I think you're right. Because the lighter is the thing that tells her, yeah, okay, I'll go with that.
On the subject of the lighter, I just need to ask, what's the wire in the cigarette or cigar for? Is it a monitoring device? Is it to make it taste odd? Is it just a weird throwaway thing? It's one of those things that's always, when I was watching it, even the first time I ever saw it, I was like, what? Did I miss something? So did I miss something?
It's not explained, because I was watching that thinking, I suspect you're right. I think it's probably something to do with making the cigarette taste different to him when he has it. But I don't know, because it's not explained.
No, fair enough.
Maybe more seasoned smokers would know what that was about.
Yeah, probably not the target audience on the cigarette front.
So you're saying that Alison knows what she's doing when she's doing it in that scene, okay? And is there anything further about that?
And so then the whole character of this particular number two and the relationship that he has with Curtis, and for me the implied relationship that he has with Susan, to me, the way that number two talks about Susan is that he was in love with her, as well as Curtis. Curtis got the girl, and he didn't.
Right.
But he, but he, but he's always loved her, and he's carried on loving her. And so when he says, "Susan died a year ago, number six," that's entrapped number six, but it's a very emotional thing for him.
Yeah, because he could quite easily have caught him out on any of the things he'd said wrong earlier, when it was like, "I'll report to him," and he was like, "What do you mean?"
The general, yeah.
Or "I'll report the general, him," and it was like, "My general's a machine," but yeah, whatever. And then there's another one as well that he gives up. Then there's a couple of like fluffs that he's probably already set him up going, really? And yeah, he's already, by the time he's reached Susan died, you're like, look's number six, you've messed up this time. Try and bluff in a different way next time.
I think also it's a great final line for the episode.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't spoon feed you at all. It's just if you've been paying attention, you know why he's caught him out and what that means. But it's not a gotcha, I know you're really number six. It's just that line is all we need and to understand what's happened.
Number two does relish the idea of like making him where they go through the motions of putting the blindfold on. It's like, oh no, remember security, you must put the blindfold on. And it was like, because I'll be able to go, ta-da, we've caught you. So that he's kind of relishing that one because it's just a nice moment.
Yes. But it does precipitate a horrible continuity error with the helicopter.
Go on, hadn't noticed.
Did you not notice?
Oh, I'm going to watch
well,
it now.
So this is, again, this is one of those prison episodes where almost all of it is not shot in Port Merion.
Yeah, there's only an aerial shot.
There's a few kind of stock shots of Port Merion to kind of show we're in the village, but pretty much
hang
all
on. It's the Norwegian church set from at L Street. That's what that is.
Is that what it is?
It's a redressed Norwegian, yes.
But usually the helicopter lands on the lawn, very obviously in Port Merion, right?
Yes.
Whereas obviously this scene is not that. Mm. And the helicopter doesn't have the big chunky landing pods.
The ski things, so they can land on water.
They're much thinner. And then when it takes off, there's a stock shot of the standard helicopter.
Oh, right. Gotcha.
So I saw that when I was looking at the episode on IMDb, like that was one of the goofs. But I've never noticed it actually watching it.
Oh, right, okay.
Which I think shows that for most people, how we watch all sorts of stuff, we just don't notice that type of thing unless it's at a particular area of interest or unless it's really pointed out, because you just go, you stop into a helicopter. Oh, there's a helicopter flying in the sky. Oh, the helicopter's landed.
Yes.
Therefore, it's the same helicopter.
Yes.
But yeah.
Well, and equally, as we've talked about before, people would have been watching this on standard definition 625 or maybe even 405 line black and white TVs.
Yeah.
And so that would have been even less obvious back in the day. The fact that we're watching it on DVD or even high def Blu-ray would have been a surprise to the people who made the programme.
Right. You know,
what do we make of the actual brainwashing process and then the whole kind of memory scene where he suddenly recalls
Pulsator.
The pulsator over his head, and then the whole kind of like
That is definitely the name for your punk band there.
What? Pulsator.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's another Captain Scarlet reference as well, because there's a pulsator that the Mistrons use to try and blow up Cloud Base. I'm full of the Captain Scarlet references because I'm watching that at the same time. There's that whole kind of... Do we find... I mean, I genuinely don't know what's actually possible in terms of like actually brainwashing people and breaking people down and stuff. Do we find this conceivable that he could have been persuaded to do this or reprogrammed to be left-handed and all that?
There's a lot of medication involved as well. And he's undergoing enough treatment and long enough treatment for his hair to grow. I don't know if either of you have ever dyed your hair, but you can feel your scalp is different if ever you've dyed your hair after a while. So I'm thinking, well, they've dyed his hair and then they dye it back to its natural colour. And then there was, sorry, haven't mentioned this, right. I'll have my girls look at it. They're very pretty. What is that? What's all that about?
It's a little creepy, isn't it, now?
A little? I think it was going to be creepy then as well. It's you might as well be like the character from the Fast Show who's going, me, the 15th Duke of Wimbledon. It's like, it's weird. It's weird the way he says it. It's also, are they in numbers? I think they're 2-4 something or other. But,
yeah. They're all numbers.
They're all numbers. It's very odd. I'm completely off track now because that threw me when I was watching it. I think it comes down to what's needed for the plot.
Yeah.
Rather than what's actually possible in real life.
Yes.
Because I don't know how... Because things like the Manchurian Candidate, where everybody's brainwashed into thinking that their boss is a lovely man and has followed the rules and is always... You know, and everybody says exactly the same phrase, which is always a giveaway, that they were brainwashed. But everyone, especially Americans, is very... especially then, paranoid about mind control. And that is a recurring theme of The Prisoner. It's like, it's the battle to be yourself. So that's there. And it's weird that the thing that gets him through is remembering that his thumbnail is growing.
Yeah.
And that's all that triggers it back. Mm-hmm. So
I suppose that would be the research. How long does it take for a bruise to go that far up your thumb?
That's true.
And that obviously tells you how long he's been...
Well, that's important
the brainwashing
because
process has taken.
Remember one of the earlier episodes where we're discussing how long he'd been in the village and he has no recollection and they're like, oh yes, the clock's changed and you've been gone for months. But has he got... Yeah, so yes. That, I don't know how long it takes for thumbnails to grow. I think it's a few mil. Isn't it like hair? As a nail biter, I'm sure you can bite your nails quite often. I don't know what that means, but
I don't know. Any thoughts on that, John?
I think it's got to be for it to grow out fully, I don't know, at least a month. I don't know. So it is some time.
I might have to Google this now while you're talking.
But yes, no. So an interesting point. So it's Wednesday the 10th of February. So I looked that up. Because I do that with my book references to find out, well, what year is that in? And it couldn't be in 1967. It would have to be either... What have I typed it up as? It would be either 1965 or 1971 that this episode is taking place in.
When I was watching like Android Invasion with a calendar in the pub,
And so when I was looking at it, so that's the date on the photo. That's the date before he goes to bed. And then the next day, the clock still shows that.
Yes.
And the tally-ho is also dated that date.
Yeah.
So like my reading is, well, you don't change the clock before you go to bed. At least this is my practice anyway. I change it first thing in the morning when I get up out of bed. So it was the 10th of February. He's got up the next day and he hasn't changed the calendar. And therefore the tally-ho must be yesterday's tally-ho. That's my reading of it. Because I don't think they'd want him to be living the 10th of February again. I think it is meant to be the next day.
Yeah, that would make it a lot more...
On the fingernail point, I have now researched it. Your average fingernail growth is 3.47 millimetres a month, I've just measured my own fingernail. I reckon the bruise gets about two-thirds of the way up his fingernail, so it probably takes about 2 months, 2 to 3 months to brainwash him.
I can't see how they can turn someone's left arm to their right hand. I can't see how that's possible. Because if that was possible, that would have happened for years, because... You know, there's always these nightmare stories about people in the 1950s getting their wrists slapped constantly when they're using the wrong hand. I'm using
But there's also a mind element, isn't there? Because there's a bit where he's half asleep and he's got the headphones on and he's kind of repeating, "I am left-handed." So it's not.
But he doesn't use his left hand well, does he? He can't shoot very well with his left,
with his non-dominant
and he still wants
hand,
to use his right. In the shooting, and he gets getting told, "Oh well, no, well, he does want to use his left, but he No, but no, he isn't. Well, sorry, I got that wrong, isn't it?
No, he wants to use his right, but he has to use his left.
And he can't shoot with it. So, yes.
Yeah. I mean, he does look unnatural. I mean, it's a good acting performance from McGoohan, but he does look unnatural using his left hand. Like, he looks like, I mean, maybe it's because we know that he's been brainwashed, but he doesn't look like somebody who's comfortable being left-handed. So it's a sort of partial success, but not a complete success.
Yeah. Right, well, let me see. I'm just going to consult my notes to see if there's anything else. Oh, can I just say, I don't think this episode would be called The Schizoid Man these days. And the passwords, yeah, not great. I mean, Gemini, there is a film called Gemini Man where the guy plays two parts, but I'm sure you can... Yeah, I think it's Will Smith. But thanks to the gift of technology, he gets to play himself 20 years younger than himself.
Yes.
But I don't think... I think schizoid's a bit politically incorrect these days. So I don't... But then again, you can't call it doppelganger because then we'd have a whole UFO conversation, so...
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also the fact... I looked this up in research that... So I knew that there was a Star Trek Next Generation episode called The Schizoid Man.
Right.
From about, 20 years after this. And the reason it's called that is because Patrick McGoohan was going to be in it.
Oh,
As a scientist who translates his mind into data as a way of living longer. And in the end, he couldn't do it. And so William Morgan Shepherd played the role instead.
Blank Reg? I know there's the whole Doctor Who reference
but
he'll always be Blank Reg to me because I'm a big Max Headroom fan. Okay. I absolutely love that series.
But yes, staple of 90s, 80s and 90s sci-fi shows and Doctor Who eventually.
Right.
But yes, that's an aside.
Is it time?
So before we go on to spot the Doctor Who actor, anything else you want to say about this episode, John?
No, so the fact which I'd... when I noticed it again, I was like, oh yes, I've heard that, but I hadn't quite taken it in. Is the number six, is that the fake number six refers to his spot on the Olympic team? Well, that must be from the real number six's dossier. So number six in his original life was on the British Olympic fencing team.
Yeah, that's true.
I take that as being real.
He was on the fencing team and can shoot and can box, which leaves much more credibility to the spy thing, or at least... Well, we know he did combat. We know he was in the war because of the flashbacks to him being a bomber.
Yes.
Oh, in Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, so he definitely did combat training of some sort, but being on the box at the Olympic team is a bit of a step up than... I mean, even in Hawkeye... she's not on the Olympic team. She was just the county champion, and she gets to be Hawkeye. So he's the Olympic. standard.
The whole boxing thing. I mean, he gets. We have the weekly punch up. One of the staples of the prisoner is he has a punch up pretty much every week. Boom. And he generally acquits himself quite well, unless he gets thoroughly outnumbered.
Yeah.
So, I can believe that of the character. Like, why not? So should we play Spot the Doctor Who actor then?
Yeah, I've got one.
To finish off. So as I said before, there are two. John, as the guest, who did you spot?
So we've got Earl Cameron, who plays the supervisor, and as far as I can tell, he gets given that role purely so that he can give the line about Haiti.
Yeah,
that he has stolen his soul, as we say, and that the normal supervisor obviously couldn't have said that.
Because this is the only episode that he appears in as the supervisor, isn't it? This is his sole. This is his sole appearance. And I did note just on that point, I did notice there's a Sikh guy right at the beginning of the episode. So you have it is a. You get these odd bits of multicultural village, don't you?
Not a lot. This is the most appearance of this sort of thing.
Yeah.
In the whole of the series.
Yes. I mean, I saw this on IMDb. It was like Earl Cameron is a black character in a position of authority. And I was like, well, yes, he's a bad guy, though.
Oh, you just, you know, yeah.
But yes, so Doctor Who, where did he appear in Doctor Who, if you can recall, John?
I can't recall that, no.
Michael?
I actually can remember.
You remember this one? Yeah.
Yes. He is the astronaut in the 10th planet.
He is, yes, who sadly dies because of the 10th planet influencing the trajectory of his rocket.
Yes, but I remembered.
You did remember, yes.
Which for me is a major step forward.
Yes.
And of course, you've just said there's someone else.
There is somebody else, and I have not... I don't think I'd ever noticed this guy before, and this is in part because until about 10 years ago, half of his episodes were missing. This is a guy who's in two episodes of a Patrick Troughton story, and one of those was in existence, but the other one, along with the rest of that story, returned about 10 years ago. So that should narrow it down for you.
No, it should, but it's not.
As to which.
So I remember now, because when you said about the 10th planet, because when I was on IMDb looking at people, because I think this is the character, because I thought he'd appeared more than once in The Prisoner, but I don't think he has. So it was the enemy of the world, wasn't it?
That is correct. And it's actually on IMDb. It's the character he plays in Enemy of the World, which is his picture on IMDb.
And I think it's the bald doctor with glasses.
It is the bald doctor with glasses. Yes, well done. So David Nettheim, who plays the doctor in Doctor Who, he had a beard as well. Playing Federin with a dodgy East European accent, who is blackmailed by Patrick Troughton in his double role as the Doctor and Salamander in that story. So there's another link. But that was 1967. So again, very similar period. And I only spotted him this time just because I have recently rewatched the Troughton era, and he's a very memorable, if short-lived, character. Who gets poisoned and dies because he won't poison somebody else. So yes, that's the Doctor Who actors for this week. I think potentially in the extras, as with any Prisoner episode, there are potentially extras who also count, but I was like, I'm only going to count speaking roles. Otherwise we'll be really obscure. You had a hand up there, Michael. Did you have anything else to say?
Looking at my notes, but the only thing I'd missed out was, is this where they start referring to Rover as Rover?
It's the only episode in which Rover is referred to as Rover.
Right. But he's called Rover by number two, rather than like as a term of, like, he's your guard dog, we'll just call him Rover.
So number six refers to him initially as Rover, and then number two repeats the word.
Right. Okay, that was my other thing. Yes. I just needed to ask that one because...
Yes.
I know we know it as Rover because we always have, but then if you think about it, why would it be called Rover? So, yeah, I get it.
It could just be this particular number two's nickname for it.
Yeah.
Because it's never used again in the show. So...
And number six calls it Rover first, doesn't
it? Yes,
yes. So therefore... But then he's supposed to be...
He's supposed to be Curtis at that point.
He's supposed to be Curtis at that point. So then maybe number two has told Curtis that it's called Rover, or maybe it's commonly called Rover, because otherwise how would number six know?
Well, yes, exactly.
So we're thinking untelevised adventure.
Yes. Yeah,
okay, that's fine. I can live with that. I can. Yeah. Right.
Cool. Well, as ever, I will leave Michael with the final word because he's been saying this for years. So I will say goodbye to John.
Goodbye. Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
It really has. Thank you for coming. And be seeing you.